Hello and welcome to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Riesendell, and I'm your host. On today's program, when the biggest commercial radio companies got caught with their hands in the payola cookie jar, they promised to play more independent music. Several years into the enterprise, has it come true? We'll find out. We'll be talking to Kristen Thompson from the Future of Music Coalition, which has been sicking their German shepherds on the case. Do stay tuned. So the Future of Music Coalition is a nonprofit group that looks to advocate for musicians, for diversity music, especially independent music. And they have certainly been doing a lot of work on behalf of independent artists and looking at how that intersects with issues of media policy, such as network neutrality, freedom of internet, and of course, what goes on over the airwaves. And they've recently released a report investigating commercial radio in New York City amongst the four top largest radio owners in the country to see, have they been playing the independent music that they promised the FCC and the Attorney General that they would? Well, to find out more, I talk with Kristen Thompson, and she is the education director for the Future of Music Coalition, and we'll listen to what she tells us about independent music and commercial radio.
Sure. At the end of June, we released the New York edition of Same Old Song, which is a companion piece to a report that we put out in April of this year, called Same Old Song. The New York edition looks at radio playlist data from 52 stations in New York State. And what we were trying to see is what has occurred with playlists from 2005 until 2008. We wanted to try and measure changes in the programming behavior at stations. And so the reason being that in 2003, 4, and 2005, there were some investigations that the then New York State Attorney General, Elliot Spitzer, had undertaken because there had been allegations of payola, which meant that there was allegations that the radio stations were being influenced by the major record labels, whether it was money or things of value were changing hands in order for certain songs to be played on the air. In that time period, Elliot Spitzer and his team at the Attorney General's office used the subpoena power of their office and uncovered a lot of incriminating emails and receipts and invoices that determined that there was a play-for-pay scheme going on. What this led to was, in New York State, some settlements with four of the major record labels and $35 million in fines, and settlements with two of the major radio station groups. Spitzer's team then sent all of their findings to the Federal Communications Commission with the understanding that the FCC would take up the role of investigating the radio station's role in this behavior because it's the FCC's responsibility to oversee the radio stations. It took a couple of years at the FCC's level, and the FCC finally had some consent decrees with the four largest radio station group owners, those being Clear Channel, Citadel, CBS, and Entercom. And as part of that, they all signed consent decrees that created sort of new rules of engagement about how they should operate as stations. And there was $12.5 million in fines collected at that level. There was also an indie set-aside that was crafted between the American Association of Independent Music, which represents independent labels, the radio station groups, and the FCC. And it's a voluntary agreement, but the goal of the agreement was to get more independent label access to these commercial radio station groups, with the sense that they wanted to increase the amount of time that indie label songs were getting, up to 4,200 hours. So this is all part of an agreement that was rolled out in the spring of 2007. So our release of this report, the Same Old Song Report, corresponds with 2 years following the consent decree signings. And we wanted to see if radio station programming behavior had changed because of these policy interventions.
And has it?
Well, our data, both at the nationwide level, at the format level, and also at the New York State level, pretty much shows that playlist composition has remained remarkably consistent over the past 4 years, despite these policy interventions. We found that neither national airplay nor the majority of format-specific playlists showed much measurable change in the share of airplay that major labels were getting versus other labels, meaning independent labels.
Mm-hmm.
So what we just saw, I mean, if you look at the report itself, most of the charts look kind of flatline. Most things in the time series fashion between 2005 and the end of 2008 show not much change in the behavior at the playlist level.
And was it generally assumed that prior to this consent decree, that the reason that a lot of independent labels weren't getting their music onto major stations, especially in major markets, was because they essentially couldn't afford the price of the pay to play that was going on, that they didn't have the pockets or the ability to make the promotional payments that a larger label such as Sony BMG or Warner Music Group could make?
That was the presumption. And we worked closely with the American Association of Independent Music on these reports, but in prior work, FMC had statements that we created about, you know, current issues in radio, which had the American Federation of Musicians and AFTRA and other recording artist groups sign on to, that showed that people that were representing musicians and labels saw that payola was a problem, or this sort of de facto pay for play. And this is what sort of started the investigations at the Attorney General's office. So it was likely that there was this indie promoter system that was fairly widely recognized, which was just sort of a one-step removed version of payola. The cash transactions weren't happening anymore because those were patently illegal, and people at the radio station level were rightly nervous to engage in that type of behavior. But the indie promoter system created a middleman where the labels would hire the indie promoter, which the person would work some particular songs to particular stations where that person had a relationship. And they were paid basically for proof that the songs had been added to the radio station's playlist. Salon, the online sort of news blog website, did a great series in 2001 and 2002 about the pay-for-play and indie promoter system that I think really raised the awareness of people and policymakers about what was going on.
But the net effect then is that it was hard to introduce independent artists on independent labels and then probably even introduce new artists at all in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I mean, I think the access to radio stations has gotten more difficult over the years, not only because of the indie promoter system, but also because of the effect of the 1996 Telecommunications Act. Because, as probably lots of your listeners know already, the Telecom Act allowed massive and rampant and very quickly moving consolidation in the radio station world, where there were 12,000 different owners that suddenly reduced to a few thousand, and some of the station owners were the biggest ones, like Clear Channel and Citadel, were amassing a huge number of stations under one company. And, you know, in an effort to streamline, they started to reduce the number of people working at the local levels. They started to program things at the regional and then, you know, format level. So, you know, all the labels, including the major labels, lost access to the people who they had been talking to at the particular stations. And now there was one person in charge of all of AC or one person in charge of Mid-Atlantic Coast or something. So access, of course, just becomes more difficult because there's even fewer people to talk to.
And so here we are, and it's been how many years since the consent decree with the Attorney General of New York State?
The first one was came out in August of 2005.
Mm-hmm.
So we're 4 years, basically.
So we're 4 years into this, and your analysis finds there's been little change, virtually no change in the amount of independent music on stations in New York State in particular. And I'm looking at a table that you have in your executive summary and looking at like a particular station, WXRK in New York City, which is a very popular rock station there. And in 2005, a total number of 7 non-major label songs were added to the playlist. And in 2008, a total of 7 non-major label songs.
Yeah.
And that's just songs, new songs added in the entire year.
Yeah.
And, you know, and that seems fairly representative for most of these stations. At the top end, a Rochester country station owned by Entercom added 30 non-major label songs in 2005 and added 31 in 2008. And perhaps one might read from that maybe there's a little bit more non-major label country music out there,
mm-hmm.
or that's popular by comparison to say, mainstream rock music.
When we looked at the New York State data by station, we were able to sort of drill down far enough to figure out just how much of the new songs added were major labels versus non-major labels. And so we were able to just build a time series from 2005 to 2008 to see, basically, has non-major label access changed over the years? And that was kind of the final step we could take with this data and figure out if there had been a change. And most of the indications were that there really doesn't seem to be much of a difference in indie label access at the station level. This resonates a lot with the findings of a survey that the American Association of Independent Music did last September. They talked to their members, and they have about 200 label members, and they did a survey, and then they did follow-up interviews with about 25 different label owners, representing a range of genres from, you know, dance and electric to metal to country to jazz and rock. And the feeling among the members was that there was the same as what this data is showing, that they don't see Paola being particularly influential right now, but they do see that their access to radio stations and programmers hasn't changed much. Very few people say that Paola is the reason. It's mostly that the Telecommunications Act has created this environment in commercial radio have come down to the fact that there's been cuts at stations, and now, in particular, with the radio industry being in such sort of difficult economic straits with the loss of advertising revenue, I think there's even more efforts to streamline and use voice-tracked material or more syndicated content, and therefore even fewer opportunities to have access to stations.
So in the old days, perhaps before 1996, is there any data that shows that it did actually happen, that it was more likely that an independent band or a new band could get a breakthrough on a local station being programmed locally that now is much more difficult, you know, when talking to a regional representative from Clear Channel or Entercom?
You have to look at sort of anecdotal evidence at that point, because there's lots of stories about how certain stations have broken artists, you know, oh, we were the first people to play Bon Jovi, or we were the first people to play Radiohead, whatever it is. Like, some stations have to be aggressive and ambitious enough to break new artists, and that continuously happens. But I know that some stations have taken a lot of pride at the local level of saying, you know, hey, we were playing the artists like the Hooters that came out of Philly, like, they were embraced by the radio stations here, and then they went on to do bigger things. And so we'd have to just look at anecdotes as opposed to data, just because this is a type of playlist tracking that hasn't been around. Well, it's been around for about 8 years with this much data being presentable, you know.
But it basically turns into, I guess, a fundamentally economic problem then, in that when a particular person or a particular station group is programming for multiple stations, you know, you have a playlist which might be at best 200 songs long that sort of dictates what gets played throughout the year, and there's only so many slots to add new things, and those slots, what few slots there are, go to fewer people because they get cast out to all these different stations, whereas perhaps if there were 10 or 12 separate stations, they would have possibly been filled up more individually And so there would have been able to spread it out a little bit more. Is that essentially the analysis?
Yeah, absolutely. And another thing we found in this work that resonates with that is that stations seem to be very risk averse. It ties in with just how much access do people have. It's also the station's comfort in actually playing a lot of new songs because they, especially at this point in time, do not want to lose listeners. And so they want to make sure that they don't alienate people by playing too much new and unfamiliar music. So they always balance it, not always, but in certain formats, there's an attempt to balance old songs and familiar hits and everything with a sprinkling of new songs. And so that's another access issue that affects not only independents but also the major labels. So, yeah, it does tie all in together that the stations are facing financial difficulties. They're risk-averse, and they're controlling of their greatest asset, which is access to the airwaves.
And yet, according to these consent decrees, the stations have agreed to do just that, to provide greater access, especially to independent labels, and they haven't followed through. So, I mean, what can be done?
Well, in our reports, we make three policy recommendations. For the most part, we direct them at the Federal Communications Commission, which really does have the mandate to do oversight over the radio and broadcast industry. We have just three recommendations. The first is actually directed at the FCC itself, because we just suggest that they do figure out what kind of data they want to collect and how often and what kind of questions they should ask in order to make them more effective regulators. Nonprofits and advocacy groups like Future Music Coalition and many other people continue to do this type of oversight and watchdog work. And we do realize that through this work that there's a lot of data out there. There's some very robust information about radio and the music industry that they could be tapping into, or they could be asking of their own broadcast licensees. They could, you know, request or require them to file certain things on a periodic basis as part of their license requirements. So we just say to the FCC, you need to figure out what you need to ask and implement it and create a way to measure change and a way to measure success. That's one of our recommendations. The second is that we sort of direct at the radio industry itself and say, we recognize that radio is in crisis and stations have lost touch with their local markets, and we're sort of distressed that they seem to have responded by pushing for greater consolidation and syndication. We believe this is the wrong way, and radio's chief advantage in this increasingly networked and internet-based world is that they are the only ones that can be live and local and free at the same time. So we join with others in the media reform movement to sort of encourage commercial radio to embrace localism. And we encourage the FCC simultaneously to take the localism proceeding that's been going on at the FCC for the past about 5 years and really set standards and set requirements for what localism means and how are they going to measure it. And our third recommendation is that we recognize, and this is sort of just a reminder, that there's a lot of independently released music that is really good, and it's very valued. It gets played on non-commercial stations. It gets played on internet radio. And some of these bands are touring stadiums and playing on Saturday Night Live, you know, like they have a lot going for them. And their absence on commercial radio is somewhat a disconnect. So we encourage radio industry to say, a lot of this stuff, a lot of people are already embracing. So don't be so afraid of it. And to the FCC and Congress, we say, you can also encourage an expansion of voices by getting rid of the constraints that are on low-power FM and allowing the FCC to be able to issue low-power FM licenses in smaller and more in towns and cities across America in a more urban market. All we need is Congress to do one thing and with low-power FM, and I think the FCC would be able to move forward and have more LPFM licenses available.
And quickly, given the state of radio, declining listenership, and the fact that a lot of people are getting or learning about music elsewhere, I mean, why should we care about what radio is playing now? And why does it make a difference whether or not radio is churning out the same old 100 tired rock songs and classic rock songs rather than debuting new artists and new music?
I think there's room for both. We recognize that some radio stations serve a purpose of just playing the oldies or playing, you know, soft rock, something that isn't meant to be the place for breaking new artists. But we should also recognize what radio's intrinsic value is, that it is a vital public resource with universal penetration, low-cost access, literacy neutral, and it's always had a rich history of cultural impact, especially at the local level. And we could think of a lot of different examples of how radio has had a significant impact on what's going on in a certain community. We want to make sure that radio doesn't fall by the wayside because we think those values are really important and can survive this transition to a more digital marketplace. We can see it with NPR, you know. They are embracing the digital technology. They've got websites and they're streaming and they're podcasting and they're doing all sorts of multimedia things and still maintaining, you know, all of their regional affiliates. I think radio can look to other people and other examples, not only in the radio world, but in the non-commercial world, and sometimes in the technology field, to figure out what technologies can assist them in being a better broadcaster, attracting more people, serving the communities better. And the same to the FCC. They have to figure out what role they should play in overseeing radio stations and broadcasters and do a better job of actually being a responsible regulator.
Great, Kristen. Well, thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Paul.
And of course, that was Kristen Thompson. She is the Education Director for the Future of Music Coalition. And you can read these reports, one about New York State and one about radio in general, commercial radio, that is, at their website, futureofmusic.org. The name of the reports are Same Old Song. And you can also find other research done by the Future of Music Coalition and look at their campaigns, such as Rock the Net, Musicians for Network Neutrality, all at futureofmusic.org. Well, I put the question out there via Twitter today. Question asking folks, why do you think commercial radio isn't playing independent music? We certainly know that it used to be because of payola, because they were getting their palms greased. But now, as you've heard from Kristen Thompson, they settled, supposedly not doing that practice, and the Future Music Coalition isn't accusing them of that. Yet they're seeing that commercial radio stations have not increased the amount of independent music they play, despite the fact that they've promised both the FCC and the Attorney General of New York State that they would start playing it. We'll see what goes on from there. But I got a bunch of responses on Twitter today, and I heard from Michi Chan, who twitter.com/MichiChan says, it has to do with the corporate tie-in between the labels and major retailers and a form of indirect payola. Commercial radio is paid by these major retailers, of course, and they'll play the music that's tied to the in-store promotion. Another tweet, music decisions are made at a national level, hardly ever regional. This is why local indie have a hard time getting play. Michi Chan sent me several tweets in a row to get this all in, and 140 characters at a shot. And also Michi Chan says some artists never make it because of perceived prejudice, such as Asian artists and others. Pirates Week at Twitter says lowest common denominator music equals greater audience and larger advertiser dollar revenue. Indie is smaller audience and less money. So he says it's basically a money game. Synprod, S-Y-N-D-P-R-O-D, also known as Syndicate Product, which is AJ Michael, the keeper of the Syndicate Product blog, tweets, because there's no one working at commercial radio stations anymore who really loves or sometimes even likes music at all. Also because commercial radio DJs don't get to pick their own music anymore. I bet they don't even take call-in requests. She says, for example, today in a third tweet, listening to WMMR, which is a rock station in Philadelphia, I heard the same song I heard them playing 19 years ago, Tesla's cover of Signs. Oh, yes, I remember that very well. Well, that's lots of answers on today's question. Why aren't commercial radio stations playing more independent music, you can send your response, twitter.com/MediaGeek. And Eric, does it looks like we have someone on the phone here?
Yes, it's Mike from Arizona on the phone.
Hey, Mike from Arizona. What do you think?
Hello, Paul. It depends on where you want to go with this. I've got a lot of things I'd like to say, but you don't have the time. Let me set the stage for you. I started in radio, late 70s. Been in radio since. Been in programming. Been on the air. Done various things in radio. So let me just tell listeners, and also I'm a citizen myself. You get the government you deserve, and you get the media you deserve.
Okay.
And here's why I say that. If you let a radio station, television station, whoever, if you let them get their license, and they've done nothing to earn that license, but you allow them to have that license, you are just as much at fault as they are. And I love radio.
Okay, so what is the average citizen, such as yourself, supposed to do?
You're supposed to go when their license renewal comes up. I mean, you stay on top of them. You watch because I don't remember ever. And I've worked on both sides of the speaker here. I don't remember a radio station ever saying on the air, license is coming up and you can come down and look at our public file. I've seen it on television stations.
Well, you're required to. If you're a radio station during your license renewal period, you are required to make those announcements. And you're actually required to make them during daylight hours, too. You can't just do them all at 2:00 in the morning. Although the required number of times that you have to do it is pretty minimal. But I went through a license renewal at a station a number of years ago, and we certainly had to do that.
Okay, I've never been through it in radio.
And I don't think I've ever heard it on a commercial station myself, even though I know it's supposed to happen.
But go take a look at that public file. Ask for that public file. A lot of them, well, I probably shouldn't say that, but there are some radio stations public files don't exist, and they are legally supposed to.
So why don't you tell the listeners about this public file? Okay, I mean, we're talking about the public service obligation of the station, right? We're talking about something that they're supposed to keep. A file of documents they're supposed to keep for public access, right, for the public, meaning you and me and anyone else as a condition of them having a license. So why don't you tell us more about this public file and why it's important and why people should take a look at it?
Because it explains to the FCC, I don't want to use the word proof, but it explains to the FCC why that license holder should continue to have their license and continue to, quote-unquote, serve the public. If you look at the FCC mandate for radio, that was the biggest thing on it. That is what they're supposed to do, serve the public. Not play music or not. I'm not saying that they shouldn't and they can't, but that's not their primary function, not by the FCC edict. It is to serve their community.
Mm-hmm.
And if you just let them get away with doing nothing or behaving as they will, they're going to keep going.
And how do you look at this file?
You walk into the lobby and ask, "I'd like to see a public file."
It should be
that simple.
And they're obligated to show it to you, aren't they?
Yes. But I've for many years, maybe even decades, I've talked to people. They say, "Well, we don't like what's going on at the radio station." Well, go talk to somebody and go to when the license renewal comes up, I mean, find out when it's coming around. If you don't like what they're doing, file a letter with the FCC explaining that you don't like what they're doing and why, or why they're not a good addition to your community.
Well, thanks again for listening, and thanks for calling in, Mike.
All right, Paul.
And that brings to a close this edition of Media Geek. We'll be back in one more week with more news and views of our media environment, probably talking about college radio with Jennifer Waits, the wonderful woman who brings us the spinning indie blog all about college radio. In the meantime, check out Media Geek Online. The Media Geek blog is at MediaGeek.net and the radio show is at Radio.MediaGeek.net. And check out my group blog where I post along with Jennifer and frequent contributor to Media Geek Radio Show, Matthew Lasar, all about radio. It's called radiosurvivor.com. Check out the Twitter feed at twitter.com/MediaGeek. All right, post my question of the week, get your comments back, and then I read them on the air. Keep the conversation going. twitter.com/MediaGeek. Have any comments you want to make directly to me? paul@MediaGeek.net is the email. And Media Geek is produced live at WNUR-FM, Evanston and Chicago, Illinois at 89.3. It is here on the Lakeshore campus of Northwestern University. And Media Geek got its start at community radio WEFT Champaign, Illinois, 90.1 FM, where it still airs Fridays at 5:30 p.m. Thanks for tuning in.